Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Amy Toy, and I am the host of Angel Answers. Today we have a very phenomenal guest. His name is Richard Moss. And before we get to that, I have a very sad announcement. My dad passed away a few weeks ago, so that's why I have taken some time off. But I'm ready to get back into the chair next month. You know, we'll definitely have some informative guests and everything. But Dr. Richard Moss, he is an awesome guy. He is called the Maestro of Deep
Maestro.
Maestro. Okay, Maestro. Thank you, Richard.
I have to tell you something. I'm never comfortable with that. A publicist created that. You know.
Okay. Well, then we'll get over it. We'll gloss over this long introduction. Or why don't you tell us about yourself? This is Dr. Richard Moss. Tell us about your background. Why don't we just do it that way? I like to have guests introduce themselves because then this way it comes from you.
Okay. Well, where are you actually? Where is our audience? I'm just curious. Is it East Coast, West Coast, Central?
It's all over the world.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, I grew up near New York, went to medical school in New York, came out and started doing my internship and electives and things like that in California. I ended up being an emergency room doctor and family practitioner, mostly emergency room. And then I had a period that started around the age of 28 of one kind of unusual experience after another that led to a profound shift of consciousness, almost like the man before and the man after. I guess you could say it was like a download of a whole different or new way of experiencing. And there are many ways people refer to it, cosmic consciousness, fundamental realization. Very similar in some respects to what some people experience in near-death experiences. No white light, no tunnel, no symbology, but just absolute, perfect, pure love and the rightness of all things. And it stayed with me forever. It's never left me. The intensity of the initial energy when I was 30, 31, 32, that has happily attenuated, or I think my body would long since have evaporated or gone back to the ethers. But so that led me to want to, I didn't have really any choice. I went from being basically science-oriented, rational materialist, science-oriented, to suddenly realizing that there was nothing but consciousness. And, you know, awareness, consciousness is the fundamental phenomenon. We cannot explain that it's caused by the brain, though people are desperately trying. And with that came spiritual experience, deep mystical experience, healing abilities, intuitive abilities. And I've been, for the last 35 years, working mostly in retreat form, sometimes short retreats, 2 days, 3 days, and sometimes 10 days. Every year, some of the retreats are 10 days long. And now 20 different countries. And I've written 7 different books on the transformational process and why and how, why it's so important and how we live it, what aspects of it are the things we have to do that are our work, and what aspects of it seem to be mysterious and come from what I would just simply call grace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's funny you mentioned that. I had 2 near-death experiences, and the second one changed my life profoundly. And I feel that the healing work, you know, not only psychoanalytical work, but also energy work is very important on the healing path. And that's what I told my clients and my listeners. And why do you call this work that you do the deep work, and how can we, like, benefit from it? How can we ourselves personally benefit from this?
I call it deep work because I've had 35 years of experience of working with just about every non-psychotic form of mental unhappiness, every form of physical illness you can think of, and what happens to the individual as they pass through these illnesses, and with their families and their relationships. Some people would say I'm a teacher's teacher when it comes to dream work. I train couples therapists, as well as working with couples and in retreat and in private sessions. So since I draw on dream work and psychoanalytic ideas, and at the same time, I'm aware of energy, I see energy, I work with energy. So that dimension of consciousness, which, and because central to all of my work is the present moment, the now moment and what we could call now moment awareness or present moment awareness, which is very different than ego level awareness or brain level awareness. I call it, it's deep work because it changes people. It changes their basic patterns. It opens doors to places inside themselves they've never experienced before or have only partially experienced and haven't known how to integrate. I never actually approach any person the same way. I never teach the same retreat or workshop or intensive the same way. Every one of them flows according to the people and where I'm at. And it is, it's profound work.
And I notice for myself, with all the work that I have done on myself, it's very hard for in family relationships that you don't want to be around that anymore. And why do you think that is? Why, when we work on ourselves so much, it's like a layer of an onion. Why do you think that happens? We can't tolerate those kind of relationships as our vibration goes up. How does our energy change through that?
Can I ask you specifically? I mean, I can think of my relationship with my mother in particular, but what are you referring to? Just a simple example.
A simple example would be when people, let's say mother, for example, is creating a very hostile family environment, manipulating those around her to kind of put the, you know, maybe have a target letter that say me or somebody else.
Yeah, okay. And the fact is, if other people do that, let's say in a work environment, you might not like it, it might bother you, but it doesn't cause the same pain, and I mean physical, psychophysical pain, that when you're around a mother and a father, but much more a mother, and I'll say why I think that's so in a moment, somehow those relationships have much more psychological impact because we go back all the way to the womb. We go back to when we were two cells, an egg and a sperm, developing, evolving ourselves inside the field of our mother, who is always, maybe, you know, depending on whether she has a husband or had a partner, her psychological and emotional state while she's gestating us is being influenced by her life, her family, her marriage, or her relationship or her non-relationship, and how much fear she's in and how much she's struggling. And that, we already have pretty good science that shows us that that affects babies in many ways. But we grow up and we have to understand we gestated inside of her field. We came out before we were neurologically mature enough like other mammals to be able to move and take care of ourselves. We completely depend on her or someone else to take care of us. And if it's our mother, so our first experience of the outer world is lived from inside her energy field. So later in life, when she doesn't grow, if she doesn't evolve in consciousness and you do a lot of work on yourself to move to, let's put it this way, to a new vibrational level, a more complete, more balanced consciousness where you're accessing not only ego level experience, but maybe some of what we might call spiritual deeper consciousness awakening experience, and you go into the energy field of your mother, and she's stayed at the same level of ego development all her life, in the same defensive patterns, the same control patterns. You mentioned a mother that's manipulative and manipulates spaces around. It's not even the behavior that's hard for us. It's the energy field. And the work that you do when you have a parent like that is, instead of allowing the sensation of being unseen, the sensation of being manipulated, the sensation of being unappreciated, instead of letting yourself turn that into judgments of your mother, judgments of yourself, and even fleeing her, the thing to do is to make a big space in your body with your larger consciousness for the discomfort. And this is how you heal. You make a big space for this discord. You don't try to change your mother. You don't try to convince her of what you've learned. You don't try to proselytize for your consciousness journey. You don't have to tell her what you've learned in your psychotherapy work or anything else. It would be futile, and it would still be you trying to gain something from her and not truly letting yourself see a mother or a father as someone other. Now, they are always other, but they have a powerful effect on us, and the best way to go forward is to let yourself feel without reacting, feel without closing down, feel without closing your heart, feel without judgment. In other words, feel without being driven into defensive, aggressive, or self-numbing thinking. And that process, that's an evolutionary process. That's how you literally contribute to your own awakening through making this big space for mother and father. You don't, you know, people talk about forgiveness, and then they try to tell themselves stories about their parents' pain and what their parents went through and what they struggled, all of which is probably true. Our parents didn't have easy lives. They had their problems. They probably most of the time did their best. I would say the vast majority of time did their best. And then intellectually, we think that by telling ourselves that, we're going to forgive our parents. But you can't forgive people with intellectual affirmations. You don't. You can only temporarily forgive them. Your energy field has to forgive them. You have to be able to go inside deep, deep into your body and in the space of your core consciousness, make a big space for them until you're no longer defending yourself against any sensation created in you, any feeling, any mood created in you by proximity to your parents. And proximity, it just by thinking or them thinking of you, is partly proximity. Being near, being on the phone, of course, that's real proximity. And then you have forgiveness when they no longer excite any form of psychic reaction in you. That's forgiveness. Now you no longer are giving any psychological energy to them because of their behavior. And that's work. You have to intend to do that. You have to practice it. It would be like learning to make a space for accepting and enjoying a taste. I remember the first time when I was a kid and I got drunk on beer. Well, the first time I tasted it, I hated it. Well, now I love beer. I don't drink a lot of it, but I love it and I enjoy it. It was a taste that I found despicable when I was 16 years old. Ugh. You know. So how did I get to appreciate it? It's desensitization in a way and new associations with the mind. But so in my deep work, I basically might ask a person to look at a story they believe about their mother or their father, one like, my mother didn't love me. And I work with that belief because what most people don't realize is when you have a belief, it's really just a concept, and all concepts, without exception, absolutely all concepts, all exists as pairs of opposites, so that you cannot conceptualize the idea of can without the idea of can't, should without shouldn't, hot without cold, up without down, and we can make lists of hundreds and hundreds of pairs of opposites. So psychologically, when we say my mother didn't love me, what we have buried is the thought my mother did love me. And what we've buried is the ability to look at our past, look at our mother's behavior, and look at all the memories in which clearly she loved us or she loved you. And so we filter them out. Because we're identified with my mother didn't love me, and we're identified with being angry about that or in pain about that or lonely about that, and we refuse to look at the other evidence, which is she did. And as soon as you do that with help, a lot of people will say, but I can't find that evidence. And I have, without fail, with hundreds of people over the years with that specific story, always been able to help them find very explicit, clear memories that communicated to them emotionally, the feeling my mother did love me. Yes, it's true. I can feel it. There's a tremendous shift of consciousness. And once you have two stories, it's impossible if you invest them equally with reality, with emotional, psychological reality, you can't sustain two pairs of opposites. Like matter and antimatter, they cancel each other. So you stop living your life with the belief my mother loved me or my mother didn't love me, because there's not a human being on the planet that is free deep in their souls that needs to believe either of those things. I can assure you the Dalai Lama doesn't need to believe either of those things, or any other person that's developed any freedom. So if you want to live in my mother did love me and bury the places where she struggled and maybe didn't, or maybe the deeper truth is your mother did love you sometimes or all the time but couldn't express it some of the time, but if you want to live in she didn't love me and be a victim of that, that's your choice. And of course, then it goes deeper, Amy, even deeper than that. Because if you have a thought, my mother didn't love me, then the next thought is, I didn't love my mother. And that can't exist without the thought, I did love my mother. So in a matter of a couple of hours, in my work, in deep work, I have, again and again and again and again, with men and with women, helped them work through, at a profound level, their mother and father stuff. And I've had them say to me, and if I've heard this 100 times, I've heard it at least that many times, we just did more work in 2.5 hours than I've done in the last 10 or 15 years of psychotherapy. Because psychotherapy is just talk, and occasionally the talk evokes emotion. But in my work, I never let anybody talk unless they connect to their body.
Mm-hmm.
So deep work takes your beliefs and your thinking, and it links it to what that does to you in your body. And then it teaches you how to set it free and free it in your body. And what we know in our body, we truly, truly know. Whereas what we know in our heads is just information.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't change us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I was very fortunate, because I had a friend of mine who, you know, she said, you know, you really need to do energy work alongside with your therapy years back. And I'm like, okay. And I really feel like actually the energy work is what got me through a lot of things and got to more stuff. But as we're on the healing path, I think we have to delve deeper and deeper and deeper. That's just my opinion.
Well, to me, as soon as you connect your awareness to your body, you feel energy, or you sense energy. As soon as you live very profoundly in the present, you're not even thinking at all. Your body, the world you perceive, the inside, the outside, it all becomes one thing, like when you're a professional athlete or when you're riding a wave and you're a skilled surfer. Or I was talking to someone who does a lot of dancing. And, you know, the exquisite, you know, when a man and a woman both really truly know how for the man to lead and the woman to follow, they can fall into such profound states of flow. And of course, I've heard this from friends of mine that are poets and artists, you know, that the execution may come through the hands and the brain, but the inspiration comes through some deeper place. That consciousness always is energetic. There's an energy. There's an energy field. Every human being has an energy field. And the more you're in your head believing your stories, and the more you're in your head defending yourself with your stories or with your anger or with your guilt or with your blame, defending yourself from your deep feelings, the lower your energy goes. So when you did energy work, you were doing work that really touches your body, not the body that we think of like a doctor, you know, a body with organs, but the body as a vibrational entity, as energy, as consciousness. And that is transformative.
Yes, it is, and I really suggest clients do that, because that would help them, you know, work through the issues in the tissue, so to speak. This is interesting.
Issues in the tissues. That's poetry.
Yeah, issues in the tissues, yeah, because the mind-body-spirit connection. You know, we have that all in there, and it's all connected. Just, you know, like my father had cancer. Cancer's caused by something there, you know. Why did he have it in his body? It was, you know, it wasn't his thinking. It was, you know, last 2 years of his life he wanted to die. So cancer was there, you know. So he didn't want to work through that stuff, you know. And I just believe that we can tell ourselves many stories. And you're right. What is that what you mean by the phrase, we are used by our thinking?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, we've been given minds, but we've not been given a handbook. So what do? We're born. Jesus says, except as you're a little child, you don't enter the kingdom. So we're born in a state of consciousness in which we don't know ourselves to be separate from anything else. So we're one with everything. But we have no power to interact with the world. And then our parents have a differentiated consciousness. Our parents have egos. Our parents use language. Our parents say the word tree when they look at a thing called a tree. And they look at your fingers and they say pinky and index and fingers and toes and nose and eyes and ears. And so all these labels, this endless, endless, endless labeling, which is essential to develop subject-object consciousness. If there's a subject, which is some part of me, or what we call me or I, then there's going to be an object, something that I name. So it's, I see the tree. I hear you. You know, but when subject object consciousness collapses, not like in a baby which didn't have that, but later in when we have what's called awakening or mystical experience or self-realization, then suddenly once again, like a baby, but now with a complete awareness of the things around you, you become one with everything. And if you don't do that, you live in the world of thoughts. And every single thought creates some form of emotional or psychological arousal. So just have the thought, my father killed himself with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have an arousal. And that arousal might be sadness.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, my father didn't want to live, even that thought. It could even be factual, you know. But if there's anything that hangs on it, like, and he should have, my father didn't want to live, but he should have, then that will cause an arousal in you, any thought. So we're used by our thoughts because we believe them, and we become identified with the sensation, which is usually an emotion like anger or resentment or bitterness or even happiness. Certain thoughts create happiness, and then we think, oh, that must be a good thought. But actually, usually the deepest happiness is experienced when we're not thinking,
mm-hmm.
when we're truly one with what is. Then we experience real happiness, real joy, much deeper.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I went all over the place just now and came back to, we're used by our thoughts because we believe them, and they punish us horribly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we ever learned. That's all that school was about, from kindergarten to first grade, to senior year, to college, to graduate school, or medical school, or law school, or dental school, or anything else. All we ever learn is to use thinking properly, let's say, as a doctor, properly, let's say, as a dentist or a lawyer. But then we're used by beliefs about ourselves, and we're used by the judgments we make of others, and we're used by the judgments we make of our careers or our bodies, because it generates unhappiness or dissatisfaction,
mm-hmm.
or urgency.
Interesting. Okay. Let's go to ego and awareness. Ego and, you know, versus quote-unquote awareness. And how does it really affect our relationships with only others but with ourselves as well?
Well, awareness is hard to talk about. And consciousness is hard to talk about. So a lot of people think they're conscious, but they're not really conscious. They're more living in patterns of self-protection and reaction, and also believing what they've been taught by religion and school and parents and culture, and trying to live the life, you know, from the outside in. They try to live from a picture or an idea about what life's supposed to be and make themselves live that. That's ego. That's ego. Now, awareness is when suddenly something awakens inside of you and it says, well, right now, for example, our audience,
mm-hmm.
I ask the audience, what part of you is hearing us talking?
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
So people that are listening to us, maybe you're in a car, wherever you are, just glance around.
Mm-hmm.
What part of you is aware of what you're seeing? What part of you knows that you're seeing things?
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about naming what you see. Don't
mm-hmm.
look. And the moment I ask a question like that, when you said interesting, what happened to you?
I just felt like, wow, new information. I wasn't aware of that.
Did you get quiet?
Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel a subtle shift into a kind of quietness or a kind
yes.
of awake? Wakefulness, but you don't really know what you're looking for?
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, so that's awareness. Awareness allows you to be aware. I just had a belief about the nature of God as it's been taught to me in my religion. But because I'm aware of it, I realize it's just a belief. I can choose to believe it or not believe it. If I believe it, it's not because it's true, because that's never knowable. No belief, we never know whether a belief is true, but we do know there is a truth to a belief. So the truth to a belief is how it makes you feel, right now, in this moment, what it arouses in you. If you have the belief, my boyfriend is losing interest in me, okay? At the moment you have that thought, it will arouse sadness or fear, right? Or anger. I mean, I don't know, you know, anxiety.
Panic. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So the truth of the thought is the panic, the anxiety, the sadness, the anger. That's the truth of the thought. And the other truth is how you behave. Mm-hmm. You pick up your phone and you call him and you say, you were looking at that woman, you know. So that's your behavior. So the truth of my boyfriend is losing interest in me is what it makes you feel and how you behave. And that's the truth of astrophysics. We now know that we have found the Bose, the Higgs boson particle, right? We found it. Gigantic experiment, tens of billions of dollars later, and we found it. It exists. And the people who found it feel ecstatic, and that's the truth. That's the only actual truth of the Higgs boson. It was predicted in their theories, so it fits the theories. It actually doesn't expand science one iota, unfortunately, and they admit that themselves. But now they have one more confirmation of a theory. And when you have a confirmation of a theory, you get closer and closer to a sense of security that you're understanding reality. So the truth of most scientific ideas that actually are real discoveries about the nature of reality, in other words, the truths of physics, like the mathematical formulas for gravity, for example, is not just that they allow us to predict and build and engineer and create technologies, but the truth is that they also allow us to behave in a certain way, and they also cause us to feel a certain sense of security about our place in the world. And so that's what people believe. You know, when they thought the world was flat, they felt if they went too far, they'd fall off. So they were scared to go very far. And so the truth of the world, the belief the world was flat was, I'll stay right where I am because it's safe here. And when people started saying the world is round, that scared people because they couldn't prove it, didn't make sense. And so then, but for the people who found that the world was round, then there was a new sense, now I understand this world a little better, which is a beautiful thing to feel. But most things we tell ourselves aren't those kinds of truths. My boyfriend isn't as interested in me, you know, may not be true at all. It would also be very important for a person who thinks that thought to think, I'm not that interested in myself. Instead of my boyfriend is not that interested in me, I am not that interested in myself. And the proof of that is right there. You're more worried about your boyfriend than you are about knowing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then if you want some compassion, you might take the thought, my boyfriend is not that interested in himself.
Mm.
And if you look at him and you watch him and you think about how he behaves and what he struggles with, boyfriend, husband, father, and you'll see maybe he's not that interested in himself, or maybe he's not that confident in himself. And suddenly, instead of being worried about whether he's interested in you, your heart begins to open and you see he's struggling with himself. He's not that interested in growing. He's not that interested in furthering himself in life. And so you start to perceive that maybe he's a little bit lost, and then comes empathy, then comes compassion. A whole lot of other things come. But when we just believe one thought all by itself, you can never, ever, ever know anything truthfully. My boyfriend isn't that interested in me. My boyfriend is interested in me. You'd have to work with both those stories. Unless it's a fact. You go to him and you say, you know, I think like you're really not that interested in me anymore. And he says, you know, well, it's true. So now it's a fact, and the fact can make you sad. You know, maybe the fact will make you angry, but it's still a fact. It's simply a fact, and people are never hurt by facts. They're hurt by, for example, if it's a fact that your boyfriend isn't really interested in you. That's a fact. He tells you it's true. And then you say to yourself, he's going to leave me. Well, maybe he's not going to leave you. Who knows? But that makes you sick. Then you say, I'll never find someone to love. And then that makes you sick emotionally. And then you say, you know, I can't live without him. And that makes you very, very emotionally sick. And that's why the proof is really, the truer story is I'm not that interested in myself. Because if you were, you wouldn't worry about whether your boyfriend's interested in you so much. You know, you have a center in yourself, two things are going to happen. Your boyfriend's going to be really interested in you, and you could live without him.
Mm. Yes.
No, who wants to be with the person that doesn't have a center in themselves?
Exactly. Yeah, I know. I'm just thinking about some of the clients that call me. They're always panicking.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is we're attracted to people who are wounded, like we are wounded. Mm-hmm. And yet maybe they adapt to their wound and behave in a different way, but they have the same wound. And so you get close to someone who has the same wound as you, and pretty soon you're wounding each other. And pretty soon you're dealing with this inner wound in yourself, both of you. And then if you work on it together, you heal each other. Mm-hmm. Pretty much we can say we're attracted to people so we can heal ourselves at an early stage of relationship. Later in life, after we lived more, we start to be attracted to people who with them we can create something and do something for ourselves and the world that we could never possibly do by ourselves.
That's very true, because sometimes that's why I tell my clients, work on yourself first and then worry about what everything else is going on, you know. But
absolutely, that's it. That's
right,
good advice.
We're mirrors to each other too. Why are you feeling insecure about him losing interest in you? Why is that? There's something within you that's screaming for healing. And some people look at me like I have three heads, and that's okay, but that's what we need to look at, you know.
Well, when they're ready, what people have to understand is, even if what you're saying to them is only your way of looking at reality, if they try on your way of looking at reality, it doesn't mean your way of looking at reality or my way of looking at reality or anything that I've just said is right or true. The fact is, if you live in a different way, because someone gives you the idea, pay attention to yourself instead of just paying attention to someone else, you will have a different result. You will have a different experience of life. So when you say to them, you know, pay attention to yourself, that they're going to change if they do that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean what you've just told them is, you know, any kind of absolute truth. It's just given them a new approach to relationship with themselves. And every time you're in a relationship to yourself in a new way, you become a new person, or a renewed person. And that process is endless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And fantastic, fantastically interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, that's something that, it's like, what's bringing this up? You know, that's what I learned in my healing work, too. Why is this person bringing this to me? Because I have an anger issue, for example. What's going on here? Why is this person bringing up such anger within me? And when you start looking at yourself, that's what I tell my clients, when you start looking at those parameters, then you really start to get involved, and it's really kind of cool getting to know yourself as well.
Well, I think one of the reasons we're attracted to work with people, and I know it's true for me, and I think it's what you just said, is that's how we grow ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like for me, in the very early years, there was some people who would be very challenging. They would be provocative. They would disagree. And I realized I was attached to my ideas that I was sharing. So I relaxed my attachment to my ideas and let them flow as contributions or offerings made to people I loved, but not something I was identified with. And then people stopped being so challenging. And then every once in a while, I would meet a really powerful, empowered woman, like Jean Houston. And we'd be in a conversation, and I'd start getting angry. And I'd think, whoa, what's this? I'd start getting irritated, impatient. Whoa, what's this? And I mean, And I started looking at, why is it so hard for me to be around a very bright, very empowered woman? And that showed me a whole lot about the patriarchal psychology in me as a man and in all men. And I started learning to make a really big space in myself for any woman, but particularly, and the exceptional ones that are really changing the world, because I don't want to stay a patriarchal man. I don't want to see women as sexual objects or just homemakers or someone to have children with or someone to carry my emotional world so that I feel emotionally secure because she's in my life. I want to carry my own emotional world. And one thing that a really empowered woman never does for a man is take care of his little boy. She respects that a man might have a little boy, but it's up to him to take care of that little boy. No empowered woman has time to suppress herself to protect a man from his insecure little boy.
Uh-huh.
Inner little boy.
And to add to that, I would say, as an empowered woman, I'm a full-time job. I don't have time to be worrying about my husband. His little boy. I like that. I'm a full-time job myself.
Well, you know, when his little boy is there and he knows it, and he says, right now I want you to be mother, mm-hmm. and I want to be little boy. Now, very few men can let themselves do this, but I want to be little boy. I want to be mommy. I want to suck on your breast. I want to cuddle up in your arms. I want to put my head where I hear your heartbeat. Just let me be little boy for a while, and I want you to be not just mother, but goddess mother. I want to become infantile so that I can disappear slowly backwards until I'm pure consciousness again. And I don't want to stay a little boy, but right now I need to be a little boy. Well, that's really powerful work in a couple, and very few couples let themselves do it. But it's essential work in a couple. Mm-hmm. So from time to time, your husband can be a little boy. He can't be a little boy unconsciously, though. He's got to say to you, my little boy's scared to death right now, and he's scared to death of you. So I need to let him, you know, mm-hmm. really become dependent on you in a way that's not emotional and psychological dependency, but in a way that allows me to really live with him and go very, very deep with him, into you, into woman, into mother. Powerful work that, you know, a couple can do. And what do you mean when you say you're a full-time job?
I have things I'm doing for myself, you know, my work, my awareness is what I'm doing for myself. That's what I mean by a full-time job. I mean, I love who he is and everything, but sometimes, you know, with this work, it's deep work. That's all I have to say on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes what happens between two couples is, you know, both people are individuals, mm-hmm. but a relationship will fail if each person lives too individualistically. You know, so how to be an individual, but live the question, what does the relationship want, and stop behavior harmful to the relationship. So even if you were a full-time job, if I were your husband, there would be times I would say, I think right now you're being too individualistic and it's not good for our relationship. Or I would say, I'm being too individualistic now. I want too much of your time. I want too much of your attention. And actually I need to let go and give you more space, or give myself more space for you to have more space. It's a wonderful dance relationship, isn't it?
Yes, no, we do. We are individualistic, but we also are a good couple together. You know, we've worked through a lot of stuff through our past. We've been together 5 years. So, yeah.
Good.
Yes, yeah, so it's... But I mean, I'm just saying sometimes each individual comes into the relationship with their own things to work out, like you said, woundings or whatever. And sometimes You have to do some individual work on that and work on as a couple, I believe.
If you have a partner who wants to work on himself and you want to work on yourself, that's grace. If two people want to be together, work on themselves, and really explore the limitless possibility of intimacy, and I don't mean just sex, I mean intimacy in the deepest, broadest sense, wow. To me, that's the most miraculous thing we can do with our lives.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
I had the experience of oneness with whatever you want to call it. Some people would call it God consciousness. And that's nowhere near as important to me as an experience to be sought after or an experience to be pursued than the possibility of profound intimacy with another human being.
Exactly. It does happen. It takes. You have to be on the same page with each other sometimes too, and that's important.
Well, I think the reason there's so many divorces now, such a high level of divorce, is because we're healing each other a little bit with each relationship till we reach the relationship where we can do more than just heal. We can create something together that's never been there before. In our field, our relational field energetically, and what's never been there before or has hardly been there before is true empowerment of the woman, a man who can really learn from the woman in every way and is also capable of offering important parts of himself and deep masculine wisdom and into the relationship. But we're inventing a relationship now. The old relationships had been invented by the church and cultural norms, and now we have to invent it. So each time you know, so many people are looking for the right guy or the right girl, but that is just completely understandable, but a very superficial way to relate, to invent a relationship. What does right mean? You know, it depends on how deeply you ask yourself, what am I here in this life to live, you know? On the last day I breathe, what if I could be a fly on the wall, what do I want to hear people saying about me? Do I want to hear them saying things about me like we'll be saying in a very short future when Nelson Mandela dies? You know, I think we already say extraordinary things about him because he is extraordinary and has lived something extraordinary. But why shouldn't every human being and every relationship leave behind a legacy that has its own form of extraordinary? And
yes.
Yet very few individuals see themselves as free, having the free will to invent that in themselves, and then very few couples have it. You know, we're just looking to be happy or safe. We're not looking to invent intimacy, invent love, invent ways of conversing, invent, you know, I'm not talking about weird kinky sex, which obviously people have invented. I'm talking about, because, you know, just, and what kind of parents does that kind of couple become? What are kids, what happens to a child that grows up in the field of two people who are absolutely honest with themselves and each other, can get completely emotionally naked with themselves and with each other? You know, vulnerable, really, truly vulnerable, and see their relationship as the basically as the vessel for their spiritual growth and their personal transformations. Wow, think about what happens to kids that grow up in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. And parents who have maybe their own wounding or their own baggage, so to speak, and that can do that work on themselves individualistically and as a couple, and really can change those patterns and have breakthroughs.
Well, it's possible now.
It's very much possible, yes. I believe totally, yes.
My partner and I, and Lisa and I, we go all over the world teaching couples therapists, working with couples, doing trainings for couples. That's one of our passions. That's the work that emerges from the two of us. My own work, of course, is been for more than 35 years, and it emerges out of my personal transformation and evolution. But I'm far more interested right now in what is emerging out of the two of us than I am in what emerges just out of me.
And with the deep work that you do, Richard, how come you think that there's major breakthroughs in such a short amount of time? Is it because you're getting to the core of the issue?
Because we're working with the body. We're working in the body. We're working directly with feeling and awareness. We're working with thought and feeling and awareness embodied. And energy, of course, because, as I said, as soon as the mind and the body become unified, there is energy. And so I transmit an energy that accelerates that in people. Annalisa and I, as a couple, transmit a potential for evolution of couples. We're not setting ourselves up as the perfect model by any means. We're just simply saying, here's what we live, and this is what it's created in our field, and our field transmits. So it's my energy field that accelerates it a lot. It's the way I work with group energy, and I've written extensively about group energy in all of my earlier books, The Eye That Is We, The Black Butterfly, and The Second Miracle were very much about energy and group energy, and the two recent books, Mandala of Being and Inside Out Healing, were really about teaching individuals and individuals within relationships, because we all are individuals within relationships. Whether we're married or living with someone doesn't matter. We're constantly in relationship. But how to stop believing stories, how to live in the present moment, and how to work with really threatening feelings. And when you work at that depth, change happens very fast. And it's not temporary change. Anybody can go to a group and rah, rah, and work from 8 in the morning to 11 at night and just get so energized that you're high as a kite for 3 days or 5 days or 10 days. But that doesn't actually transform you unless you go home with a practice, unless it's deep in your body and you know how to keep working with it. So, yeah, people can change very quickly. And if they want that change to take root, then they have to use practices. I used to go help herd cattle on a cattle ranch. We did it on motorcycles. I can tell you, moving bulls from one pen to another on a motorcycle and having to get up and prod them with a little electric prod or scare them, make them move, it's a little tenuous. But that man that I did that with heated his house with firewood and had all his life. He chopped wood. He had a wood burner. And he could chop wood so efficiently. All the wood came from his land. He'd cut it into rounds, and then he'd split the rounds with a splitter, and then he'd take an axe and take that wood and cut it into kindling that could go into his big wood-burning central heating unit. And if I was near him and I started chopping wood with him, I chopped wood so well. And then when I went home, if I kept him in my mind, I could chop wood really well, literally chop wood and not chop my fingers off. If I forgot about him, I became clumsy again. So his energy communicated to me in that simple behavior. My energy has a powerful effect on people, just gigantic effect on people. It takes a whole room of 300 people and moves them into almost dead stillness in about 5 minutes sometimes. But that's not enough. You then have to go back and chop your own wood, mm-hmm. metaphorically speaking. And so the last two books, I'm almost 67. These last two books represent work since I turned 60 or so. I really wanted to put out into the world as simply as possible the practices, the awareness practices and meditative practices and centering practices, and work with thoughts and work with feelings that were really transformative, that have transformed, really profoundly transformed my life, or allowed the transformation that happened all those many years ago to really become permanent instead of just temporary. And it would have been temporary without practice.
Yes, when you are changing patterns in your life. Yes, very much so. But it can be done. It definitely can be done.
Do you and your husband have a practice or practices for your relationship?
We have a few. Yes, we do. We come from very wounded households. And we're still working on things, you know, spirituality, meditation, that kind of thing.
You do that together?
Yes. Yes,
we good.
Do. Yeah. And that's what keeps us very centered and very, when the you know, because, you know, relationships, you weather storms. And, yeah, definitely. But there's still, you know, things that it's going to be an ongoing process because I always like, I like to push it to the envelope just a little bit for me, you know, get deeper, so.
There's an interesting, my, Annalisa and I went and interviewed and videoed a couple in their 80s who are, that I know of, and we now both know of, that have been Jack Zimmerman and Jacqueline McCandless. They wrote a book called Flesh and Spirit, but they've been pioneers in exceptionally creative ways of bringing energy work and psychological work and sexuality and interrelationship and also what they call counsel, a form of very specific form of conversation where one person is never interrupted when they speak by the other person. And so it's called Relationship as an Evolutionary Path, and it's a video on my website. It's a download. I think we charge $24.95 for it because it cost me a lot of money to go and do it. But it was my passion to put out to the world what these elders have created out of their lives together, out of a 40-year marriage, which was her fourth and his third, I think. And so now they're well in their 80s, have a deeply active spiritual life and sexual life, which is just totally remarkable. And they're still going strong. So you might find it a very interesting video to watch. And people in the audience might find it interesting too, especially if they're interested in living relationship in a very creative way, moving toward profound connection and intimacy, and depth of understanding and self-healing. And we'll be doing another video in a few months with another exceptional couple. I'm very interested in the forms of consciousness and spiritual teaching that are emerging out of relationships as opposed to coming out of some very exceptional man or exceptional woman. Because I think that's really where evolution's taking us. That really the deep wisdom is we, not I. So what emerges from the we?
Exactly. Well, Richard, we got to wrap this up. This has been awesome. This interview has been wow. How can someone connect with you and experience the deep work for themselves? Where can we find you? And
my name, www.richardmoss.com. The website's called Deep Work for Essential Change. And I just found www.richardmoss.com. And for specific short videos, 5 minutes or so, that teach specific centering processes, there's my YouTube channel. And there's a video called The Art of Listening. There are 4 videos. I don't know if they're all up yet because we load them like once every month. We add a new one on centering and meditative practices for starting presence. And there's a free e-course on the website. There's a 2-part free e-course, part 1, part 2. I think the first part is 5 and the second part is 8 lessons. And they teach people how to do the mandala work, which has to do with bringing your thoughts back from past and future and judgments of yourself and others and learning to start right here in the present and heal yourself. Heal yourself by being in the present. So that's all there for people to find. And I have would love people to like me on Facebook. And I'm always putting something up, or sometimes from my books and sometimes just from what I'm living in the moment on Facebook. So that's how people get to connect with me, and I really hope that they find the book Inside Out Healing, because for a very, very, which they can get on Amazon. You can order a book on Amazon and have it in 3 days. And that book is changing people's lives. I get emails every day about how that book has taught people how to truly change their lives and really works. And it's an awareness approach, and it's much more than a psychological approach. So thank you, Amy,
Richard.
And I'm sorry about the loss. Sorry about the loss of your father.
Thank you.
And we all have to pass through that. I've been an orphan for a long time.
Yeah. Well, everyone, it was a pleasure this week. Thank you, Richard, for coming on. And everyone, have a good week. Thank you.